Hi, my name is Michael Poli, and I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. My friends are obsessed and always make jokes and references to it. And so now, 20 years later, I've been convinced to watch the show from beginning to end, one episode a week. I'm a Buffy virgin.
Well, welcome to another episode of Buffy Virgin. This is the season one finale episode. I can't believe it. We watched 12 episodes of Buffy. I watched, and we also managed to meet 12 weeks in a row to talk about them. Almost everyone was there every time. I was there every time for sure. It's been quite an adventure. I thought we were going to be able to get through the season one stuff during episode 12, but there's just too much to talk about.
Also, I just left.
Also, yeah, Dennis had to take off. So with me today is Dr. Travis Frog.
Hi, everyone in the Buffyverse.
He's a doctor. We have John, a Buffy enthusiast and teacher.
Hello.
And Dennis St. John, famous horror cartoonist.
So famous, guys. So famous. Hey, happy to be here.
So we have a lot of questions that Travis sent in advance, seeding some conversations to have about season one of Buffy. I have some questions as well. They're a little bit more sarcastic. We'll get to those after we get through a couple of Travis's questions. Maybe we'll do two of Travis's, two of mine, and back and forth here. And then if there are any other questions I want to throw in, but this is going to be more of a roundtable conversation about our thoughts about season one of Buffy. So the first question you have, Travis, do you want to read it or should I?
Oh, no, I can read it. So I guess the season review, what are each of your two favorite episodes and why did you pick those episodes?
Great question.
Who wants to start? I'm ready. I've got notes.
All right, John, let's have you start.
All right. So my answer for this, I was sort of looking at the season through the lens of, it really is about high school, and sort of looking at the season through the lens of, you know, how it might be the same or different from other high school fiction, you know, John Hughes movies or, you know, whatever. And the things that really stood out to me were, first of all, Out of Mind, Out of Sight. Really appreciated that episode because I think it cast a little bit of a different light on the archetype of the outcast character in high school fiction, because you have, and I think I did cover this in that episode a little bit, but the, you know, you have our characters, you have, you know, especially Xander and Willow, who both of themselves see themselves as outsiders, but then they have, that's sort of dwarfed by somebody else's condition. And kind of makes just gives a sense of the relativism of relationships and the relativism of happiness, and that you can feel like an outsider, and still there's somebody else who feels more so that way. And then my second choice, for similar reasons, was I, Robot, You, Jane, which is my absolute favorite episode from this season. First of all, because of the technology nostalgia, I'm not going to lie, I just like seeing computers from the 90s. It just makes me happy. And to see some of the naive ways people are talking about the internet. But more than that, I think that the episode is a really nice antidote for one of my least favorite episodes from the season, which was Teacher's Pet. I thought Teacher's Pet, I'm going to jump ahead to my least favorite, but I thought Teacher's Pet was, Horndog Xander is like the worst part of season one in a lot of ways. And that episode really focuses on Horndog Xander and this like really cartoony stereotyped version of teen male sexuality. And so it was cool to see I, Robot, You, Jane that was sort of an opposite telling of a similar story where the relationship was real, but it wasn't real. And that's a really cool dichotomy because I feel like that's the conversation we're having all the time right now with about our Facebooking or Twittering or whatever, where we talk about it like it's not a real relationship in some contexts, and we self-flagellate for not having more face-to-face time or more face relationships. But at the same time, we're still having real emotions. And I thought it was neat to see something playing in that territory and talking about that as early as, what was this, 97? So that was pretty neat. Those are my two favorites.
Oh, yeah. Well, speculative cyber fiction in the 90s.
What was your other least favorite episode, John? You said Teacher's Pet.
I think I'm definitely not alone here. My other least favorite was the puppet show. I don't know if I really need to justify that after we did that episode the episode we did on that. I don't have any more reasons why I dislike it other than the ones already stated.
So my favorite episodes, I actually really like, when I thought about this stuff, I really like episode 11 also, Out of Mind, Out of Sight. I feel like that was one of the strongest episodes in the season, though it has a lot of things broken about it too. It's a lot of fun, has really great pacing, really enjoyed it. I like the story about being invisible, and I think like what we talked about it in episode 11, but just great themes, great story. And then the other one, as I think about it, I really like Teacher's Pet because I like the way that really attacks horny Xander and punishes him for his horniness. But I'm frustrated how he learns nothing from that experience. However, I like that kind of story and setup. It's really simple, but I haven't seen it done before, even though it seems like such a simple, obvious one to do. And I like stuff that explores teen sexuality. Like, I think that a lot of the kind of hot for teacher fantasy, like, is usually explored in the dumbest way possible. And this was like a fun twist, at least, even though it could have been deeper. That's the story. I think if like I were to turn something into a movie, I'd like want to play more with that. I think there's a lot there.
Cool.
And my least favorite, Puppet Show is terrible. It has so many red herrings and BS in it. That one, and then I'm torn here because Never Kill a Boy on First Date's pretty rough. And I Wrote About You, Jane, I don't have the same feelings for, but I'd say Never Kill a Boy on the First Date is the other worst episode from the season.
It's a lot easier to, like, there's a lot more choices for worst episodes than best episodes of the season. My top ones were the Nightmare one and Prophecy Girl. I didn't prepare that much to say about them. I thought the Nightmare one, like, was surprisingly creepy. You know, there's a bunch of stuff this season I didn't remember really well. And obviously, I didn't watch Out of Sight, Out of Mind. That sounds like maybe it was probably like a solid one I should rewatch. But I thought Nightmares had like a bunch of creepy scenes, like Buffy digging out of her own grave and Xander's Nazi clown terror. And it also had funny stuff. So I thought that was a solid episode. And I think Prophecy Girl is like just a totally solid hour of like telling a story. Telling a full like monster adventure and killing a character and bringing her back and everything. Like, I mean, I talked about it last week, but I just think it's a solid episode.
I would definitely say that's number three. I mean, episode 12 was great.
I think when we started the Buffy Virgin podcast, Dennis, I think you gave people the advice to watch which episodes again? You said,
Welcome to the Hellmouth, The Harvest, and then Angel and Prophecy Girl.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that, Dennis, you recommended those less because they're great episodes and more because they're sort of arc episodes that will.
Yeah. They fulfill the arc of the season and you can skip the terrible stuff.
The puppet show.
Yeah. So my list of least favorite is puppet shows, number one, and then the pack was my second least favorite.
The pack's pretty bad.
The pack is awful, partially because it has no real monster in it, because. It's just an awful episode. It doesn't fulfill like any of the stuff I like about Buffy. So,
Dennis and John, I love you both. The two that I wrote down for best episodes were I Wrote About You, Jane, and Out of Sight, Out of Mind, like John. And then Dennis, my two worst episodes was The Pack and Puppet Show. So
nice.
But I guess since no one talked about it, I was on the fence about talking about the episode Angel. It's actually a good episode. A few reasons. It kind of furthers the plot along in a meaningful way that hadn't happened in a few episodes. But, you know, it's important that Joyce is attacked. I know I harp on that a lot when I talked about that episode. Joyce is attacked. And then Darla is killed. The downside of Angel will always remain. the bizarre end to that episode with Darla having two guns and having this weird John Woo shootout. If that didn't happen, that episode of Angel would be a whole lot more impressive. Like, if there was just like a normal ending, that episode definitely, I think, would rise to the top. Or just, you know, I don't know. So to me, that's, you know, the Angel episode was good for a lot of things. I wrote about you, Jane, just simply didn't have any weak spots. It was, to me, it was all had a great story, had a fun monster. It had like a really fun flashback. It combined all these different elements. Now, just out of mind, I really only picked because the final fight scene was so memorable. And it showed that Willow and Xander can also be evil character, can be the bad character. That hadn't been done at all this season. So that's why I picked those as my two best. I still think Angel gets an honorable mention. Maybe Prophecy Girl, of course. But yeah, the pack and puppet show were unmemorable. The pack is what I didn't like about the pack primarily is that it kills off a well-loved character.
R.I.P. Flute.
You know, in a bizarre way, it's actually, the thing is, when I, before we did this, I actually like the pack. It's fine as like as a standalone episode if you don't care about anything other than you wanted to watch 44 minutes of Buffy. That's it. You know, it's in some sense it's good. It's a Xander focused episode and strange, but when it has just all these negatives compared to all the rest of the episodes, season one. Puppet Show, what I really didn't like about Puppet Show, I kind of liked how insane Puppet Show was. What I didn't like was the fact that they actually found a monster at the end. I still think that Principal Snyder should have been unofficially the suspect. He should have remained the suspect rather than Buffy and Giles finding the demon at the end of Puppet Show. That would have been my preferable ending to that episode.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it would be great to go back and fix some of the episodes from season one. There are definitely a lot of like little things that kind of ruin aspects of it. So I have kind of these lists of like my favorite scenes, my least favorite scenes, darkest moments, and most important moments. I know that's a lot of things to go through, but
let's hear what you think, Mike, because you're the Buffy virgin.
So feel free to respond to this, but I'm gonna go through these here. I know favorite scene is a pretty crazy question. You had questions set up for episode 12, and I basically answered those for the entire season, which is a little insane, but I'll get into it. So favorite scene from the whole series of series one is, and I think it's like the most fun moment that I think defines what it is that you, as what we like about Buffy, and I think what people like about Buffy, and it's when it's episode 11, the Invisible Girl app, when Cordelia recruits Buffy and the gang to help her, and it's just a fun, stupid scene, but it's like it's really like charming, and it's like, hey, Cordelia's trying, you know, very, very much to convince the gang that she still thinks they're a bunch of nerds and she's not worth her time to help her. And it's a dumb scene, but it's really fun. And it's the scene I found that I laughed the most at in that episode. So that was like my favorite scene, I think, of this series. And I want to see more of that kind of scene. And I was surprised there weren't more of them. That's kind of what I expect when people think Buffy was like going to be a fun show, was more of this kind of back and forth. And really, there's a lot of tragic things. So now I'm going to list my least favorite scenes. And I think that there are things that break this kind of mythology of Buffy, at least the way it's portrayed to me as a fun show. So in the puppet show, okay, mythology of Buffy, but also like this extended universe stuff that clearly isn't wrapped up anywhere. So like in the puppet show, when Sid explains all this stuff about another Slayer that he was involved with, and there's this weird puppet confessional moment, that's like, that doesn't go anywhere, and I know it's not going to go anywhere. And, or maybe it does, you guys can make a face, but like, that was like that's a game-breaking amount of information. The Secret School of Invisible Assassins at the end of episode 11. Every scene with Angel in episodes 1 and 2, when he appears and offers meaningless advice. And then I have these lists of dark moments, which again, I think are kind of game-breaking moments here. When vampires kill everyone on that shuttle bus in the episode of... it's when they get the anointed one. Which one is
Never
that?
Kill
a boy on the first date.
Never kill a boy on the first date. Like, that's so horrific, and it's a terrifying scene, and I don't think it... Certainly, it's great to play something so horrific, but, like, I think it's much more horrific than it's intended to be. when Buffy and Cordelia are tied up and tortured by the invisible girl, like, that's a great scene, but I think it's a little bit too dark for the show in some ways. I think the show wants it, like, especially the way that episode ends with this, like, goofy FBI agent scene. It's just such an uneven scene. When the pack, when they eat the principal, like, when they eat Flutie, like, that's so dark. And a crazy choice. And then, of course, they make the decision for them to remember it, which is a great decision, but, like, it's just so dark. When Angel kills Darla, his old lover, like, that's ultimately, that's, like, such a sad scene. When the ventriloquist gets murdered, but because he has a brain tumor, they don't want to keep his brain, so he gets thrown out. When the baseball coach, it turns out he put the kid in a coma, right? Like, that's terrifying, like, and so messed up. And then when all of Cordelia's friends and her boyfriend is murdered by vampires in episode 12, it's just like, these things are all like, they're really shocking, awesome horror moments that do not fit, I think, the implied tone of the show from the intro. The intro is like fun, action, adventure, 90s. And then, like, these things are just game-breaking tones. I like all of them. But, like, when I talked about my favorite scene, which is that moment with Cordelia trying to convince the gang to help out, like, that's a fun, uplifting scene in, like, a pretty dark universe that doesn't feel like it wants to be grounded in darkness, but clearly, like, is. And maybe that unevenness is a part of Buffy, but, man, like, if that's the show, wow, what a crazy show.
Yay! I'm glad we're watching this with you, Mike. I take that so for granted when I watch Buffy, because I think at least that one.
You guys talking made me think that's something I had to say about iRobot Eugene. And about the season in general, is like, that was an episode I was dreading because I remember it being really bad, and I really enjoyed it in this rewatch. I had a fun time talking to you guys about it, and the moments I like remember being awful still were, but like there was like so much more enjoyable stuff. So that kind of has been my experience through this season, is like, for season one still isn't very good, but there's a lot more to enjoy than I remembered. So thank you guys for inviting me on this journey. Like, even terrible episodes, like The Puppet Show, still has a really funny Xander with the dummy moment where he's like, I'm completely inanimate. Like, that's a funny scene in a terrible episode.
Yeah, so the show, to me, seems like it's levity amidst really heaviness, like a surprising heaviness that the show, in season one at least, pretends doesn't exist. Like, and like, yeah, like The Puppet Show, like, wow, playing with the puppet, huh? Ventriloquist got his brain removed.
There's already been at least, yeah, a couple deaths. I don't know. I think that's interesting stuff. I mean, I think in my, like, in real life, like, sadness is mixed with humor, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, we joke when we can't cry, right? I don't know. Like, when I was doing caregiving for my grandma, oh, God, terrible stories. But, like, she was also really, her dementia was really funny in a way that other people's isn't. Like, she thought I was a dentist, you know? I've already told this story, I think, on this podcast. But, like, she asked me if, like, you pulled any teeth out of any young ladies? Yeah. So, like, that would, you know, that wouldn't be, that's funny because she's like losing her mind and dying, right? Like,
yeah. I'd say, like, when someone at my work, she has a rare form of cancer, when she was telling people in private about it, you know, she told me about her rare form of cancer, which she's currently on leave for this experimental treatment. She was like, I want to laugh. Please do not treat me differently. I don't want this to be who I am. And I mean, definitely, like, that's another aspect of traumatic, like, of terminal illness, right? It's like, you don't want it to be your identity, right?
Yeah.
In that way, like, we all want to laugh, right? So you're right on, Dennis. Like, me saying that this is, it's so weird. I mean, it's very realistic in that sense. Well, but I think the way that Buffy isn't sentimental about death is like, is maybe true to life, but it's not true to these 90s shows.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that one of the reasons I relate to this show is that that maps on, to some degree, with my high school experience and with our high school experience, that, you know, there was more life and death drama, I feel like, happening around us in high school than happened in any other 4 straight years of my life. And I feel like that is how we handled it. We did handle it with levity, and we handled it with detachment.
With being idiots.
So, like, I mean, to me, that's one of the things that's attractive about the show's, you know, basic metaphor, is that, you know, as kids, you don't know what's normal, so you treat everything as if it's day to day. And that's kind of how the residents of Sunnydale handle things.
Yeah, well, I mean, well stated. I totally, yeah, I mean.
I don't know. For me, this season one, I feel like it's just a lot of really strange things happen. I mean, it's very much a season one of a show.
I
understand your complaints. For me, maybe I can't really talk about how the other seasons feel, but, you know, I guess for season one, you know, I was rewatching the beginning part of it, and it just very rough. Like, they just really hadn't found their footing.
Yeah.
For me, the second half of this season is clearly much stronger than the first half. You know, if you take out the pilot, on average, more of the better episodes are in the latter half, puppet show notwithstanding.
So moving on to some of Travis's questions here. I think most improved actor and actress is a really tough question because it's only one season of a show. And it's more like a change in, like, different actors got different stuff written at different times.
Yeah.
Like, there's different writers, and some writers wrote more dialogue or better dialogue for different actors. I don't have a sense of anybody, a serious improvement. I think that question would be better to revisit season two recap, like, what's the most improved, maybe season to season, but...
I can say who's the most improved character.
Yeah. Who's the most improved character?
Well, I think Cordelia is easily the most improved character because she's written so one-dimensionally at the beginning. And then later in Out of Sight, Out of Mind, they suddenly decide to give her other aspects to her character. And it happens pretty much all at once. And it's really nice to see.
But I mean, is the best actor, best actress? I mean, is that something that, I mean, it's... You know, what actor or actress did you end up caring about the most? Is that a good question?
I have a contrarian answer to that. I think that Ken Lerner as Bob Flutie and Chris as Joyce are really awesome on this watch through for me. I mean, I've talked in the first episode how much relate to the adult characters all of a sudden in this show, and it's, I think, their performances are a big part of that. The way that they are able to communicate the fact that they care and the fact that they don't want to listen simultaneously is, I think, a really cool thing for an actor to be able to do. And it really comes through for both of them in all the scenes they're in.
Yeah. And I'm really glad that you're on this show to talk about that aspect, John, because that's something I think I would miss personally. Like, as someone who hasn't, I mean, I work in education, but not like you, not with the kids, not in the school, not in the wild. Like, I don't have that connection to those characters necessarily, but I mean, I'm an adult, but like, I don't feel connected to them. That was really awesome to hear that when we were going through the early part of this season. So I want to ask Dennis the best monster question, because that's like the person you want to hear from. What was the best monster in season one?
I think the makeup on the demon in I, Robot, You, Jane in the very opening scene was like really great. And it's like, way above everything else in terms of like demons
and like 10 seconds of footage.
Yeah, I know.
It was like Bram Stoker's Dracula, that like Francis Ford Coppola has amazing, you know, sets and costume design. Like, yeah, it totally looked like it could have gone on one of those films.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe it was a really rigid design and it wouldn't look good for more than 10 seconds.
Like darkly lit. I also really like the master. I think the master doesn't get enough respect. He's the master, man. you know, and I mean, it's a failure of the season that they don't, that it's the structure of the season that he's trapped the whole time, but like, it would have been great to have seen more of him. And I think the actor who played him is interesting and weird. And the last monster, the final like Lovecraftian thing is great, because it like breaks the world a little, where you're just like, it's the only one that's not like a guy in a suit. It's like non-humanoid at all, and just like a thousand strange things happening.
Yeah, that's a good point. The fact that it's not just like makeup really contributes to the oh shit aspect of the last episode.
Yeah.
And then, Travis, you have a question here, best set and lighting. Now, I would like you to answer this question first, because I don't...
Ah, the Bloods!
I think you have an answer in mind.
Oh, no, that was written mostly out of just frustration with the lighting that happens in season one. I'm not sure what the best set in lighting is. I'm enthralled by the fight scene at the end of Out of Sight, Out of Mind. It's crazy. It's in the bronze. Hey, that's sad. The
bronze is usually so terribly lit.
It is. Maybe that's why it's cool.
I don't think I've mentioned before that I really like Buffy's room in this show, just because it's like, it's not a TV character's room as much as it's like a normal person's room. Like, usually I think of like a teen character's room being like weirdly large, you know? But this is like a small space and it's got like the angles from the roof on it. So I just thought of that right now. I like that room.
I can tell you, worst set.
Yeah. Angel's apartment.
It's not the worst. No, the worst set is like the park she hung out in Teacher's Pet, where she ran into this monster with a razor blade on his hand, and they fought for like a minute. And you couldn't see anything.
Old fork.
Forks.
I forgot about fork hand. And the Master's Lair is pretty good. It's spooky. We could have explored that more.
That actually is an excellent. That's probably the best set of all the, because it's so large.
Yeah.
I could talk about how bad Angel's apartment is for like a whole episode. Like,
not as bad as you guys make it out to be. I don't know. Your hate for that.
Dr. Flong, ladies and gentlemen.
We need to take this offline, and I need to really find out what is your reason. There's not a good reason.
It's like got character, but too much or too little. Like
it's normal. It looks fine.
Dude, if that that might be the way you're living, but the rest of us want to not live in like some refrigerator.
You have like one spotlight on one statue in your apartment, Travis. Is that normal to you?
I've lived in a walk-up apartment. It's a ground level where half of it's underground. I mean, you know, it is what it is sometimes. You know, it was a fine apartment. I mean, it was like on a hill. So you walk into the apartment and then the rest of it's underground.
Angel's apartment reminds me of an article I read in Archaeological Digest. Architectural Digest. Very different. Where they talk about like how to make a room. And this is like a criteria for making rooms in your house for ladies, right? And it's like, hey, interior designers, what you need to do is have one unique object in each room and draw attention to it. And that will help build the personality of the room. And that is Angel's apartment. And it's an object.
I know he's 248 years old. He's going to have some objects you want to put on display behind a glass case.
I'm sure it looks like, you know, the warehouse in Indiana Jones when we pull out and reveal what's really going on there. But
so I also assume Angel is a squatter, right?
It really seems that way. The impression, I mean, I understand why he would want to live underground, but it really seems like it's like a storage unit maybe, or like maybe like some kind of strange like extra room in the sewer system, possibly. It's really unclear what it is.
He kicked the Ninja Turtles out.
Oh, one more thing about Angel's apartment. You know, like the whole idea is like there's a couple times in this season where there's issues finding where people live, right? Because it's 90s or whatever. Like you can't just look someone up and know where they live.
Right.
It's easy-ish to find Angel's apartment if you really want to.
Oh yeah, Xander just goes there. He's the last person who should know where Angel lives.
Well, I guess it's his worst enemy, so he's got to know.
Always know. Yeah, well, but I mean, Buffy's house is the only like real established exterior of any of these characters. Like, see Willow's...
That's a weird read on Xander, that like he hates Angel so much he has like a hate address book of people he hates. Is that like what we're saying about Xander? Is that the kind of person he is?
He probably hates Angel so much he jerks off thinking about him angrily.
So speaking of Angel, what was the most irrelevant Angel scene? And that it's a hard question.
That is a hard question.
Because I'd say it's the first appearance, but he does that's when he gives Buffy the necklace, right? In the first appearance.
Yes, it's, and that's a very important object later on.
How many times is it going to be mentioned that David Boreanaz was found while walking a dog this season?
So this is a tougher question. What was the most horrific, no, maybe it's not that tough, horrific Cordelia PTSD moment after this?
Like the trauma she endured, or like a stupid line she said?
Oh, it's the trauma she endured. Yeah.
Oh, it's easily. Last episode, her boyfriend is murdered and she finds his corpse.
That's pretty bad.
Does she have another boyfriend that gets, I guess he just gets injured. He doesn't get killed.
Yeah, he doesn't even, no. He doesn't get killed. Yeah, I think that's got to be it. The blindness is a close second.
Yeah, it's tough being blind.
Yeah, the car crash. Yeah,
and does she get her, like, I haven't seen Outside Out of Mind, obviously, because I keep saying that. But she get cut in that episode.
Yeah. They like on her cheek. The face.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. She gets a local anesthetic in her face, and then gets like her face cut up while she can't.
That's a different episode. Awful. That's episode 11. Episode 12 is the one where her.
Yeah.
Prophecy. Yeah, that's where her boyfriend gets killed. But.
So what was the? This is tough for you guys, right? But what was the worst horny Xander moment?
The worst moment with Xander is not really Xander's fault. It's on Giles, which is where he basically admits, you know, he Giles is like, oh yeah, you were under the influence of a possession and tried to rape Buffy, but I'm going to totally cover for you with a smile and a wink. That was the worst Xander sexuality.
Oh.
That was awful. That was just plain terrible.
Just boys being boys.
Yeah. Because Giles is like, yeah, I got you on this. I won't tell anybody. It's like,
I think not as gross, really, but I think season episode 3, where he like gives Buffy the like bracelet that he's obsessed over, is just gross to me. Creepy. And makes me like feel really bad for everybody involved.
Yeah, that's totally cringeworthy. It's awful.
Those are all great moments to bring up.
And none of them involve him trying to fuck a mantis.
Yeah, there's a couple bro moments in Teacher's Pet where he's like, that's right, this is happening. And he's competing for, you know, seconds with another jock character or whatever.
Yeah.
They're like really tough that don't age well.
How do you like your eggs, bro? Extra character. We already talked about the inconsistencies of that in that episode, and that extra character is horrible.
He's horrible.
All that dialogue right there is just atrocious.
So, speaking of extra characters, this next question: what was the best actor who's only in one scene? That one's pretty tough. You got to really stretch your brain. Obviously, Pork and Beans is a pretty
He was more than one scene. One episode, though.
Okay, this might be too
old.
Dr. Gregory.
Dr. Gregory was really good.
He was actually literally only in one scene.
I like the girl who has her mouth sewn shut with magic, because her horror is pretty believable.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
And then what was the most tragic death of a non-main character that really, like, affected you?
Probably Flutie.
Does he feel like Flutie?
Yeah.
Easily.
Delicious, delicious Flutie.
And then I had one for you, Dennis. What was the best master moment? What was the best moment when we spent with that guy?
Best master moment. Him killing Buffy. I think that was a solid, creepy scene. I think it's a moment of like real horror in a show that rarely goes there. And the fact that, like, despite the fact she's a slayer, he's basically killing her as easily as he would kill any other victim is like creepy, you know? And just dropping her in the water is like a freaky moment.
I'm trying to remember which episode it was, but the one where he's touching the cross and experiencing a little bit of like little pain and has a little like monologue about pain, that to me was the most affecting. That's what I was hoping to bring up. But that one is also killing Buffy's good.
That one's good also, him touching the cross.
Well, I have my predictions for season 2 based on season 1 here. I'm sure I've made many. But I think so Buffy coming back to life in episode 12 after being killed. So, is she a vampire now? I expect this question to be answered in season 2. you know, how, what happened to her when she died and how she was revived and what's going on there. I expect another principal to die and be replaced. I expect Cordelia to have more terrible things happen to her. I expect the cadence of at least one terrible thing per episode. She can have two episodes off. Mostly, almost every episode.
So in 22 episodes, something terrible will happen to Cordelia? Okay. I have to keep a score.
I expect Xander not to get a girlfriend ever in season 2. That will be too soon. Maybe by season 5, you can have a girlfriend. I expect Willow, we haven't had a Willow dating anybody episode. I expect season 2 to have a Willow meets a guy episode. Oh, no, I guess IRW Jane, she sort of does. And I expect, like, a more...
Dating a demon does not count.
I think in the Buffyverse, it counts.
I think it counts. Yeah, if you're gonna disqualify demon relationships, that's a lot of relationships out the
Never
window.
Mind.
Throwing dispersions on demons out of nowhere, man.
Never mind. I'm sorry. Yes. Okay, keep going.
But the big problem for season 2 for me is, like, we killed the principal adversary, the master, so there isn't really another villain to fill their shoes, like, besides the anointed one. But the anointed one's only job is to point out where Buffy should go. Apparently, like, a really simple job, and to yes and the master. Like, we need a big villain. So I think we'll be vampires, but I don't know what vampires. But I like the idea of a master-like personality becoming a thing, but it can't be the master. So it's not going to be an old-timey vampire. It's got to be a newer vampire, like a smarter vampire. Like, that was the Nosferatu vampire. Now we're going to see the, you know, like an Interview with Vampire, at least, like a different type of vampire in season 2. We need vampires.
Yeah.
For Shinra to be a vampire slayer.
There was only like one vampire-centric episode last season, so it's funny where you're like, there's got to be vampires. So I guess there's like a couple episodes.
Oh, yeah. No, I get it now. There'll be vampires in the opening episode and in the closing episode.
And in between, just monsters.
And in monsters.
Now, Mike, you... yeah, okay. Yeah, never mind.
I predict that Giles will actually train Buffy in season 2. I didn't see a lot of training. There's like one or two-ish training montages. Giles, in order to really responsibly be a watcher, needs to train Buffy. I'd like to see some of that happen. I assume it will. I think I've covered all the characters. Buffy, Buffy, we're going to figure out what happened when she died. Giles, Xander, Willow, Cordelia. That's everybody, right? But Joyce. Joyce will also be completely oblivious of what is going on in Buffy's life throughout season 2.
No, Joyce.
Good. Those are good.
Those are excellent. Those are excellent predictions, Mike.
Thank you.
They're very interesting.
Very interesting.
I started a spreadsheet to track Mike's predictions. I've been putting them in as I'm editing.
Good.
But if anybody wants to...
Yeah, please share with me
some that spreadsheet and throw things in there, because it'll be handy to look back when one of them is, you know, definitively confirmed or denied. It'll be fun to talk about.
Great. So episode season 2 is a bit longer, right?
It's twice as
long. Yeah, it's a full season.
All right. Well, we will finish this midway through 2017.
Mike, let me hear just like an overall season recap from you, like, without getting too specific. We know you have your preconceptions, but, you know, did you like this season?
I couldn't have done it without you guys.
Well, that's the nicest way to say it.
I enjoyed watching the show every week, and I did it out of sense of obligation in some ways, but also like I did enjoy talking about it. And I think you can watch almost anything if you get to talk about it later, right? Like, so if I know that there's gonna be a moment where I can air my grievances, I'll watch anything. Overall recap, like story.
Story recap. Just, I don't know. I guess I just never. I mean, I guess you just don't really like it that much. I don't know. I'm just trying to get a sense for this.
I found it really refreshing and fun to watch a 90s show in 2016. Like, I really wanted to do this. I didn't realize I wanted to watch an old show and talk about it with my friends. Like, a lot has changed, like, since then and now, and it's cool to revisit some of this stuff, through, at least through media. We can't really travel through time and go back to high school. Not that we want to do that. This is probably the safest, most fun way to travel back in time. But that part's great. The emotionally, you know, time traveling back to this period, but, you know, having a lot of hindsight, it's been great. As far as, like, the show, I mean, the show is somewhat immaterial to that. It is, you know, it could be, we could watch another show from that time. We could watch Dawson's Creek, you know, and I'm sure I'd have a similar engagement in some ways.
That would be an interesting podcast for Saul to watch Dawson's Creek and be like,
I never watched it. I didn't watch it when it was on.
Oh my God, John could be the Dawson's virgin.
Right, ours are a series of virgin shows.
Oh yeah, I'm also a virgin for Felicity. Just saying.
Oh man, that's a better show.
You're not a Friends virgin though, right?
I think I watched a fair amount of that. I wasn't a huge fan. I dated someone who was a big fan though, and I found that annoying.
I guess it's fun to see. I have some mixed feelings about this. It's fun to see what adults wrote for this television show when we were sort of adolescents. Like, that's kind of fun. Like, historically, like, so that was interesting. I don't know. I keep thinking about, you know, stories that have lasting value. To me, a lot of these kind of had lasting value. I don't know. That's maybe just because I reread Pride and Prejudice a couple weeks ago, but that's, you know, that's 150, is it like 170 years old? So, you know, watching something from the 1990s or the 90s, 1990s, that's okay. That's not too far-fetched, I guess, compared to, you know, so, other things we read and enjoy and feel are still relevant. So to me, it's just relevant. It's weird.
Totally relevant, but it's also a show that we're like, that won, right? Like, it's not like we're looking back at a show that got canceled. Like, this is a show that clearly won. Like, Joss Whedon is now writing the biggest budget productions that exist, you know, all the Marvel stuff, right? Like, you know, Firefly, Serenity, whatever aside, like, this Dollhouse. I mean, I know the stories if you haven't seen the shows, right? Like, Whedon won. You know, this version.
That's nice. We need a winner this week. Oh, I didn't think about it in that context.
I mean, we say it won, but it had to move from the WB to the UPN. But we're not going to get into those details.
Yeah, we are.
It's all the same station now, man. Yeah,
now in this reality, it is the same. You didn't have to move at all. But I don't know. So going back to my original thing is, even though it's just, I don't know, it just seems like these stories. At first, I was really down. I'm saying, why am I still interested in this show? You know. I'm sort of down on it because it just seems like it's something that you shouldn't be, because it's not like people are still watching, you know, endearing, like, you know, really like emotionally watching reruns of Step by Step or Family.
I'm sure they are, right?
Right. I'm sure there's some people, or even like Family Matters. I'm not sure. What was the one that was Michael J. Fox was on? Was that Step by Step?
Family Ties.
Family Ties. You know,
But people are rewatching every incarnation of Star Trek.
Yeah,
I am right now. I'm permanently watching some kind of Star Trek.
You know, maybe just made me more just saying, you know, just rewatch whatever you want to rewatch. If it's Family Ties, it's Family Ties. If it's Step by Step, it's that.
But this ended up being perfectly appropriate, you know, and John really nailed it. You know, I think talking about, like, you know, our high school experiences, like, this is, you know, this is the perfect group of people to watch this show with, for me personally. Like, here's a show about high school I'm watching with people from my friends from high school, best friends from high school. We are revisiting this show together. There is no more perfect magic for me to do this with. And I think that has been the most exciting part of doing this. Like, I've really enjoyed this experience of having an excuse to reconnect with you. And I feel like other things that we've attempted have not worked. And this works because it's pretty easy-ish.
Yeah.
It's very easy for me, and I like that it's me-centric, so this is great. I'd love to explore some other things that are less poly-centric. But apparently you're all passionate enough about Buffy that, you know, this is a doable project, which has been great. I don't know. It's just like the chemistry has been really right on for this. So.
So I'm gonna say season two is the best season of Buffy. So that's my opinion.
That's a heavy opinion.
Yeah, I don't agree with that at all.
Whoa!
But we can save this for the season 2 wrap up. Maybe I'll change.
No, we should. We gotta say it now. Well, so I believe season 2 is the best season. John, you don't, but Dennis.
No, I don't either. I mean, are we what gonna season? Say what our?
Yeah.
I'd say probably best overall arc is season 3, but best episodes are like season 4 and 5.
Yeah, best episodes are definitely season 4. My favorite arc is season 5, but I understand a minority opinion in that.
Whoa, season 5?
Your minority report.
That's so much television.
I like season 5 a lot. I think season 3 has the best. They're still in high school. It's got like, but they've got their shit figured out really solidly. But like season 4 definitely has like the best episode, and season
There's
5
some amazing
has, like,
one-shot episodes in season 4.
Yeah. And then like season 5 has like probably a really strong episode in it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and so does season 6.
Episodes that you think are great. I'm excited that this is all like considered trash in the Buffy universe and skippable.
Oh yeah, it's all uphill from here for sure.
Yeah. I know, wait. No, downhill.
No, it's uphill. It's better.
It's better.
No, no, it's harder. Uphill is more difficult.
Yes, we're mixing our metaphors here. It gets better from here. It will not be an uphill battle.
It's all trending upwards. How about that?
Yeah.
Just it gets easier, right? No metaphor.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're all right. John and John
this
and Dennis.
Cut all this from the.
No. This is important. This is the reflections on season 1. Season 1 is incredibly important in the total scheme of things. This is
sure. The scheme of things. Yeah, I agree.
Another thing about this that's been refreshing is like these episodes are kind of self-contained stories, and that's not true anymore about television. And like that's kind of refreshing.
An episode. Like, I would say season 1 definitely highlights. I feel like season 1 has a lot of self-contained stories, and then 4, 5, 6, 7 has self-contained. And season 2 is the season where you just can't miss anything.
Yeah, Dennis really nailed it when he said that the trade-off with really arc-driven television is that it becomes a slog. You know, you watch a million episodes of The Walking Dead, and they're all exactly the same.
That's because that story is all the same.
Yeah, I mean, I'm picking The Walking Dead because it's like the worst example of this where like, you know, it's all arc and so nothing actually ever happens in a single episode, you know, or it builds these, you know, huge crescendo moments that, you know, it just takes forever to get to.
And even those crescendo moments take place over a couple episodes, which is so fucking frustrating, man.
It is. It's really frustrating. And so it is. It's nice to see something that still has a sense of like telling a complete story in an hour. And again, I'm just repeating what Dennis said previously.
Yay, me. I'm being quoted. Oh, hey, guys. I'm going to be on the local radio next week, I think. We're talking about my comics. So,
plug the podcast.
I'll plug the podcast. I will. And but all this talking on podcast maybe, hopefully, has helped me with my radio voice and getting ready for that.
Those of you listening to the podcast, whenever you listen to it, you need to Google Dennis St. John radio interview and...
It's like the morning show on Wednesday afternoon or Wednesday morning. It's not KQE. I should look it up before I say anything about it. It's in Santa Rosa. It's the Santa Rosa.
WLVR XY
95 800.
just Google Dennis St. John radio interview, and I'm sure the first thing that's going to pop up is that interview.
We're on the like the bottom of the second page of results for Buffy Virgin.
Finally, well,
we'll be bigger. Don't worry.
It's gonna look good.
My mom was like, "I was like, I googled your podcast, and you came up on the very top." I'm like, "Really? That didn't. When did that happen?" And she's like, "I googled Buffy Virgin John Landis." I'm like, that's so good because we've been trying to really, you know, we should pay our SEO guy more because that's great.
It must be frustrating, John, to have your name and like
It's actually a gift. It's a blessing in disguise because my students can't Google me, which is awesome.
Oh, nice.
So I don't get any friend requests from my students. I don't get like anything like that. But once every 3 months, I'll have like a 10-year-old will come up to me in the hallway and be like, "Mr. Landis, did you direct Thriller?" Because like they see it, they watch Thriller like everybody does fairly regularly. It'll come back up in their lives, and then they'll like, you know, they get old enough where they can read, and they're like,
and you're just an adult.
Exactly. I'm like, yeah, I totally directed Thriller when I was younger than you.
Yeah,
do it better again, Michael.
It's funny the regularity of which that happens. Like every Halloween, somebody says that.
Interesting. That's interesting. It's Thriller. John Landis is over.
Regardless of the John Landis connection, is that the horror movies of the 1980s continue to be the go-to touchstones for kids, which is amazing to me. It's still Chucky, Jason, Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger. Those are still the boogeymen for them. I don't know if they've actually seen the movies or at this point, if it's just like basically urban legends to them now.
Interesting.
They don't anything from a recent film when they talk about what they're afraid of.
Well, I think recent films, I mean, I could do a whole series of podcasts about recent horror films, but they're all pretty much the same and they're not interested in the monster anymore. They're interested
That's very true.
The thing they're good at is they're basically, and I realized this while I was doing 9 haunted houses with Mike, is like, they are really good at, like, they basically build haunted houses. They're really good at the jump scare, the you know, the setup, the switch, and then the jump. And they all take place, like, the best jump scares take place when the character is in bed, because that's when you're most vulnerable. And it's like episodic TV, they're not distinct anymore. They're like, right. I mean, I just watched Ouija, or however you say Ouija.
Yeah.
And it's not, like, distinct from The Conjuring 3, or I mean, I see all these movies, but yeah.
It's funny to me that they're focused on jump scare to me, because to me, jump scare is something that works best in the theater. And you would think that in this day and age, they would be trying to make horror that works in different contexts.
Horror movies still get really large audiences, yeah, at least first opening week. And I think kids like the 80s monsters, because they are recognizable. And like you can know them without seeing the movie, and that once a monster becomes like well known enough, it's like scary, but it's not like nightmare inducing scary.
Well, there aren't too many monsters that have like really made it as a part of our mashup culture, right? Like the Slender Man is the most recent one I can think of. That's kind of like an internet.
Oh, dude, Slender Man's amazing. I use Slender Man in my class all the time because kids believe it's real.
Oh my god.
Hold on,
you need to explain that sentence, John.
Well, no, because like I guess
that's how the 13-year-old got stabbed, right?
Yeah, so there's that story, right? So with children, there's always this tenuous grip on reality anyway, where they will insist something is real, but emotionally they're not really dealing with what that belief entails. So like I had a long conversation with my students, many of my students, during the clown scare of several weeks ago. I had students who insisted that it was real, and you could tell that like they weren't quite coming to grips with it, because if they did, they would be more scared or like,
yeah, man, 2016, when we can look back on the clown scare and be like,
yeah, well, how quaint. Yeah. But
2016.
But so we had a lot of great conversations, you know, about how do you tell what's real on the internet? And, you know, that was where I was going with it. But, and, you know, talking about what is a fact and how do you try to assess when something is factual? And how do you try to get some basis for believing something, which I think is hard for adults, but especially hard for children who have no basis for, you know, what's real or not. And they're seeing in the news even, you know, discussions of killer clowns. I think that's really tricky for them.
I'd say the aesthetic of this, of Slender Man, is totally the aesthetic of right now. The new Tim Burton movie has like Slender Man looking things in it. The new Blair Witch movie had like the Blair Witch had the Slender Man shape. Yeah. that fucking, not The Conjuring, but that other series that that guy does, the one with the Warrens, the newest one of those has like a Slender Man type dude in it. Like that is like the aesthetic now.
It's hard to say a kid believes anything any more than anything else because their belief is very fluid. But
I also believe in Santa, like a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But because for them the boundary between belief and play is sort of fluid, I think. But a lot of them. But with Slender Man, they will at least insist to you that it is real, and you have to have this awkward conversation with them. And then there's a degree to which you're killing Santa Claus, where you're just like destroying the magic of childhood.
But the interesting thing about Slender Man is like we know the origins. Like there's a trackable forum where people are like, let's create something, right? And like let's Photoshop something and create a myth.
Absolutely. But that's hard to for a child to see that and hold that up like that, especially when you know your literacy skills are still developing and reading something like that is difficult. To hold that up in one hand and on the other hand have this like emotional truth of finding something frightening.
Yeah.
For kids, emotional truth is this huge thing, I think.
No one would disagree. I was just thinking there's this video game, and I can't recall the name of it. I think it's like Sleepaway Camp, Sleepaway Camp something. And like, it's just like a stupid puzzle game, but all the characters are just iconic 80s villains. And like, this is kind of like a...
Are you talking about Five Nights at Freddy's?
No, different game. This is a new one that just came out. It's Steam.
I know my students are obsessed with Five Nights at Freddy's and how scary that is.
Yeah, kids are obsessed with that game. I don't get it. Yeah.
Like, I haven't played it. It looks really stupid. It looks really stupid.
Yeah,
it's But you can buy the merch at Target and stuff, so it's really hit the...
Yeah.
It's a jump scare game, and kids just want to make these Let's Play videos, and kids are getting so good at narrating their play
that it's
insane to me to like see those skills.
Let's play phenomenon is blows my mind.
I mean, I get why you want to watch a video for a video game you don't have. You're like, I want to see what it's like. But the the personality personality shows like, you know, Howard Stern or whatever, you're watching a personality driven show. I mean, I can understand that, especially in a chaotic world, like returning to that same personality probably.
Thanks for listening. Reach out to us at BuffyVirgin.com in the comments section to talk more about Buffy. Anyway, thanks so much. Have a great week.